Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So a lot of people noticed during Biden's State of the Union that, well, he kind of made it through. He managed not to pass out or fall down or completely blank for the most part, though he did have that cough that sounded like he should be in some kind of tuberculosis camp. However, the big moment everyone took away from that was probably the Lake and Riley moment where he forgot the name and everything. And that was kind of the story coming out of it. But I think another big point that people didn't pay as much attention to is that Biden actually declared war a couple times during that discussion. Not enough people actually, I think, picked up that point. But one of my favorite commentators did. His name's Kevin Dolan. He writes under Bennett's Phylactery, both on Twitter and on Substack. And I wanted to have him on to talk about that. Kevin, thanks for joining me, man.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. So as you picked up, and a lot of people didn't, Joe Biden repeatedly declared war during that speech. Who did he declare war on?
Well, yeah, he was a little subterranean about it, but he was essentially declaring war on his domestic political opponents. And he was likening our current moment to both 1861 and 1941, and the implicit message of both of those things is that, like, it's war is inevitable and appeasement is impossible and morally wrongheaded, and therefore, like, all you can do with your enemies if you're sort of placing yourself as the protagonist of 1861 or 1945, is to crush them, destroy them. And, that's at the same time, he's arguing that political violence has no place in American politics, which I took that to mean essentially that we're going to extirpate and immiserate these people by legal procedural means, and we would very much like it if they went along with that as quietly and orderly as possible.
Yeah, it really did seem strange that more people didn't grasp the language there. When you invoke, as you said, 1861 and the 1940s, it's very clear you're talking about the need to go through an entire reconstruction or denazification process, right? That's the illusion. That's the kind of power you're saying you need in both of those situations. I need to be able to not only defeat my enemy, but it's important that I go through and be able to completely purge them, change their way of life, alter them in a very substantial way so that we can once again rule over them in their entirety. And I think that a lot of people just kind of blew past that rhetoric as if it's not important. In the piece you wrote, you explain a couple different ways that you think that's going to happen or is already happening. And you also explain some ways that people might protect against that. So I want to dive into all that, guys. But before we do, let me tell you really quickly about ISI. Universities today aren't just neglecting real education, they're actively undermining it. And we can't let them get away with it. America was made for an educated and engaged citizenry. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute is here to help. ISI offers programs and opportunities for conservative students across the country. ISI understands that conservatives and right-of-center students feel isolated on college campuses and that you're often fighting for your own reputation, dignity, and future. Through ISI, you can learn about what Russell Kirk called the permanent things, the philosophical and political teachings that shaped and made Western civilization great. ISI offers many opportunities to jumpstart your career. They have fellowships at some of the nation's top conservative publications like National Review, The American Conservative, and The College Thinker. If you're a graduate student, ISI offers funding opportunities to sponsor the next great generation of college professors. Through ISI, you can work with conservative thinkers who are making a difference, thinkers like Chris Rufo, who currently has an ISI researcher helping him with his book. But perhaps most importantly, ISI offers college students a community of people that can help them grow. If you're a college student, ISI can help you start a student organization or a student newspaper or meet other like-minded students at their various conferences and events. ISI is here to educate the next generation of great Americans. To learn more, go to ISI.org. That's ISI.org. So at the beginning of this piece, you kind of predicate a lot of what you say in this piece upon the fact that you think the United States is kind of facing a pretty impending financial collapse. Last week, we had a bunch of conservative commentators be like, you know, Social Security, that's the end of the Republic. That's the thing that's going to take it down. Now, obviously, Social Security is essentially a Ponzi scheme. It will collapse your financial system eventually just due to the math involved, especially if you're not having children, which is something else you talk a lot about we might get into. But you identify some other problems that this might be a little closer than just the Social Security fund going bankrupt. Why do you think America is in the position where it's got an impending financial collapse?
Well, essentially, all the methods of expropriating and redistributing wealth that are dilutive, like inflation, like mass migration, and basically ways of sort of reducing the individual citizen's stake in the country, or their stake in their own wealth. Those methods they've been exhausted, essentially. And so what you're looking at is we've got a deficit that there's no real political will to arrest that deficit or even the growth of that deficit. And if you do the math, the national debt will equal the total market cap of all U.S. stocks in by 2035. And so it's like they're going. And Balaji Srinivasan put this in a really interesting way. He said, they're burning $10 billion a day, which means that the U.S. government is eating the value of a billion-dollar tech unicorn every couple hours, which is like, and I think that's for his audience, which is composed of guys who like know how hard it is to make $1 billion, and it's just unreal. It's like I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with Warhammer, but the God Emperor on his throne commanding the sacrifice of 10,000 every day to sustain his unnatural life. That's kind of where we're at. Basically they're not able to use the sort of monetary policy and the shell games to fleece people anymore. And the spending, there was nothing to arrest the spending. And now it's reaching a point where in order to maintain the loyalty of their clients, which is, it's you know, maybe partly ideological, but it's overwhelmingly just a matter of interest, right? It's like who's going to give me the free cheese? And to maintain the loyalty of those clients, they're going to have to go get some real assets, which means they're going to have to take them. And I enumerated a couple of ways that might happen. Credit to Balaji on that as well. He's talked a lot about sort of the ways that wealth is being expropriated. So I can't take credit for the whole for sort of what I put forward there. But it's selective seizures in civil and criminal cases, like you saw with Elon or with Trump or with Alex Jones. It's selective targeting for like IRS audits. It's even things like from like an anarcho-tyranny perspective, it's things like allowing your sort of client class to squat in other people's property and refuse to evict them, which is, it's a de facto transfer of that asset, which is, it's sort of a, maybe not effortless, but like very low effort way to take something from somebody you don't like and give it to somebody who's in your pocket. So it's things like that that I think are coming down the pike and that are already sort of emerging on the fringes.
Yeah, I want to talk about that transition real quick because I, you know, we're big believers of elite theory on this podcast. Everyone here who's been listening for a while is familiar with the notion that elites are the ones that run society for the most part. They're the ones that are going to influence your decisions, your culture, these things. And so in a very political realist set of terms, the government really is, this is the one thing the libertarians are, my buddy Charlemagne said this, I'm just going to steal it outright. The one thing libertarians are right about is that the government really is just a gang that's here to steal your money. What they don't understand is you want to be the gang. But there is this transition between, you know, we have these, like you said, those dilutive methods. We understand that at some level, the government is always taking money from the populace and redistributing it to their clients. That's always going on at some level. But there are levels of that that are long-term, sustainable, at some level, actually even healthy for the nation. And it actually grows its stability and its ability to reliably create complex systems and these kind of things. And what we're seeing now, which is really just the copper being stripped out of the walls at this point. And so I want to talk about that transition, because what are the big shifts, the big things we see when the government goes away from just its normal job of kind of taking your money and giving it to its friends and full out saying, oh no, we're going to go through these wild methods of, you know, we're not even doing this through a complex systems of bureaucratic manipulation. We're just literally going to let someone squat in your home and make sure you don't do anything about it.
Yeah. And I think when I hear libertarians talk about the role that the state performs, I think there's a very direct analogy to be drawn to the way that communists talk about management. They view it as like completely parasitic, like it's not a service that's being provided. And I actually disagree. I think governance is a service. I think that that providing a bubble of stability and security and maintaining a predictable and reasonable level of you know, the fact that the government gets to decide what you're what they're going to charge you for that service is, you know, that sort of complicates the analogy a little bit, but it's one of these services that has to be provided as a monopoly, and so it's just sort of that's the nature of the beast. But these institutions exist everywhere, and it's sort of a necessary component of the ecosystem. And what you are seeing now, and I think ultimately government is most functional when the people in charge of it feel a sense of kinship and a sense of stake in the body politic as a whole. One of the things that Yarvin has said on that subject is that, like, with his formulation of like a hereditary monarchy, it's like this family has this long run investment in the state, because in a sense they own the state, and so they are incentivized to invest in its long term flourishing, and also they feel like a personal stake in its beauty. It's not a commons. Whereas in a democracy where the pendulum swings every 4 or 8 years, it absolutely is a commons, and anything you don't eat is going to be eaten by your enemies as soon as they're in power. And so there's this inevitable gravity toward short-term thinking and toward being rapacious and frankly, just kleptocratic. And so even conservatives, when they're, or, you know, whatever you want to, however useful you think that term is, conservatives will take power and they'll bark about the deficit until they're in charge, and they'll do nothing about it. And it's just the deficit will go to defense spending instead of to welfare spending. And there's a, you know, you can accuse people of moral turpitude over that. But when absolutely everybody is doing the same thing over the course of generations, I tend to think, there's something systemic here. There's something there's an incentive gradient that is driving people toward this and sort of fulminating about how they're such bad people and they're such crooks. It's just not useful. It's the actual structure of our system of government that's causing this problem. And we're basically at the point where those contradictions are beginning to come to a head, And you can see that in the stakes for this presidential election, where both sides have, I think, a reasonable expectation that if they don't win this election, they will be at minimum shut out of the systems of power and shut out of their sort of personal career for a long time if they don't actually go to prison. And so their incentive is to do literally whatever it takes to either get in power or stay in power. And I've pointed this out several times, but like many of the people running the blob these days are literally the same people who ran like the Clinton admin in the 90s. And they weren't acting like this. They may have still sort of been the same kind of people, but they weren't acting like this. And I think it's this accelerating process of the stakes being raised on them and on the system as it kind of comes to a crisis.
Yeah, it feels like you said a lot of people would look at the Clinton era and say, okay, maybe some things were out of whack. Maybe there's some signs that eventually we would end up in a worse scenario, but it didn't feel like people were, preparing to eat each other, in the sense that you're talking about. And part of that is the ideological acceleration. It feels like it's become more and more important to signal your complete distinction from the deplorables, right? In every way, it doesn't matter what Donald Trump says, it doesn't matter what someone on the right says. The key thing for you is to be on the opposite side of it, no matter how radical it is. It doesn't matter if you're shoving puberty blockers down the throat of an 8-year-old. Like that's not what the people in the red states do, so we do it. And it's wholly because it's the opposite of what they do. And it feels like, I've had a lot of people get angry about the invocation of Carl Schmitt and Schmittian politics. And how could you wish this upon people? As if this is something that people who are observing reality have foisted upon it, instead of just something that is clearly observable to anyone with both right. eyeballs. And so, like you said, I think there is an incentive structure here. And this is what Carl Schmitt says, is as long as there's a democratic process, politics must enter all of these realms it previously did not enter. As Yarvin says, the power is loose. And when the power is loose, everyone has to do everything they can to secure it. There's no such thing as acceptable loose power. It simply is not. It's not something that you can allow to happen inside your system. And so you have to attach it to something. And so the competition becomes more and more aggressive, and politics has to go ahead and pierce every sphere of society. And so people get more and more crazed about, what they're going to signal on and what they're going to do to their enemies. And I think the left have much less of a reason to be worried about the right and them being shut out in perpetuity. But they certainly look at what they have done and said, man, if I was the other guy, I sure would do these things back to me. And so they definitely want to make sure that they've built a weapon that is simply too dangerous to hand over to their enemies, because public opinion was 51% the other direction. It's simply just not something that's ever going to happen again. And so you see the levels of vitriol grow, but more importantly, and I think this is what you really hit on so well, was you see the methods of expropriating what exists, what material benefits your opponents have, increase, because they're simply not going to allow you to own property anymore. They're not going to allow you to have jobs anymore. It's not just enough that you'll be ruled by these people. It's that you can have no assets available to you, because they all need to be stripped from the evil people and redistributed to the good people.
Well, there's that saying, if voting mattered, they'd make it illegal. And here's what I would connect that. So I was talking to, or I was posting on Twitter about Bitcoin and sort of the advantage of being able to the fact that it can only be taken from you if, somebody like pulls your toenails out and makes you give them your key phrase. Right. And somebody pointed out to me, they were like, hey, look, man, it's actually the TradFi, traditional finance mechanisms of third parties that like prevent that from happening. It's actually like a service they provide. Like, it's actually good that, that, you know, even if you pull my toenails out, I can't actually give you access to financial stuff because somebody else is stewarding it. They have custody of it. And in much the same way, I think what has happened with social media is that it has actually, it has made free speech, freedom of speech, a practical fact of American life. And that's fundamentally why the system is freaking out. Because if you had free speech in principle in the 90s, like Alex Jones was around in the 90s. And you know, post 9/11, he started to get a following, but like, I remember Alex Jones people around that time. And like, I was a very young kid and I was like, these people are weird. Like, this is a very strange, very fringe, subgroup. And now it's like the institutions of, the sense making and like who decides consensus reality, institutions of American politics and policy are like, they're dealing with Alex Jones as a peer threat. Like, he is not some wacko that they can dismiss. He's a wacko that they have to deal with. And, right. And they're very, they're taking the gloves off. And I think you're seeing that with Elon Musk. Basically, all sort of the promise of the internet, of sort of freedom of information, and it's all real. It happened. We got the dream, and it turns out that there's a lot of people in charge who don't want to tolerate that.
Yeah, I want to drill down on that because I think that's actually a really critical point. But before we do, guys, let me tell you about your absolute moral duty to hire based people through New Founding. Hey, guys, I need to tell you about today's sponsor, New Founding Talent. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find anybody to get the job done. The competency crisis is very, very real. So how do we get these two incredibly important groups together? We need organizations like New Founding. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. These are individuals often in elite organizations who are ready for a team and a mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using this network to hire high trust, exceptional individuals who can match the culture and mission of their teams. So if you're looking for better employees to build a better world, you need to go ahead and apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll get connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Check it out today. All right. So you hit on that fact that there's been a realization of free speech on the internet in a way that probably most people don't appreciate fully. A lot of people look back at, I don't know, like the AOL days or something, because I'm old enough for that to happen. I remember when the internet came on a CD and a 32K modem. But a lot of people probably look at that and say, well, that's when there was real freedom of the internet, right? Because, you know, everyone wasn't plugged in and there weren't all these censorship algorithms and that kind of thing. And there's some truth to that. It's a Wild West scenario to some degree. But also everyone wasn't online. And so it was something that people were learning to do. Like your parents figured out they could check email, you know, that kind of thing was happening. But there wasn't this constant presence of online. And we can say a lot about the deleterious effects of that. Obviously, it's probably not healthy for people in very large ways that most people now live a large amount of their life online. However, what it did do was give very large platforms to people who, like you said, never would have gotten within, you know, arm's length of mainstream media. And so, I mean, guys like you and me, I was teaching high school a year and a half ago, you know, and it, much different world now, you know, talking to a lot more people than I would ever have been able to I never would have been able to enter into some kind of broadcast TV talk radio scenario. And here I am. Why? Well, because I got good at typing things on Twitter. You know, same thing, you know, with you. There's a lot of people who would not have these platforms. And of course, like you said, much larger people like Alex Jones. And that really changes the way that things work, because when everyone went to the TV box for their information, you still had to filter a lot of things through the mainstream media. The edgiest network was, you know, Fox News, which, you know, now seems like a joke today, but that really was the breakout. And now there's an entire different world, information ecosystem, that goes directly to people and bypasses pretty much everything. And the fact that Elon kept that from being chopped off at the knees is a huge threat to the regime. And so it really is fascinating to see the way that they are panicking, because, you know, the same technology that they laid the groundwork to do things like, I don't know, the Arab Spring, you know, yes, they're using it to try to do color revolutions here, but it also means that, you know, the same roads that got the Romans from city to city also brought the barbarians at lightning speed.
100%. I mean, the whole misinfo, disinfo panic is them recognizing that ideas actually do have power. And like, they're actually right on the object level that if you can lie to a big enough proportion of the American public, you can manipulate the democratic process in unhealthy ways. And basically, the only terms of the disagreement that we have with them is that they're the ones who should be trusted to decide when that's happening. Because like, that's essentially like every sort of right wing or conservative American who critiques democracy, they critique it on that basis that you can just sort of snow people, lie to them, and I mean that's. When Tucker talks about the 2020 election being stolen, he talks a lot less about stuffing ballots, and he talks a lot more about the suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop and the alteration of the terms by which people vote. And so it's not necessarily that it was stolen by flatly illegal means, and it was more stolen by the connivance of the media in terms of lying about what was happening, which led people to make sort of a decision that he regards as suboptimal. And Democratic and leftist commentators will push back on that with him, and they'll be like, wait, nobody stole it. It's just, you know, that's just all in the game. People can, like, you know, concoct narratives, and these narratives, and that's how democracy works. And it seems like both sides are taking both sides of that issue, if that makes sense. Like, both right wing and left wing commentators are sort of giving up the game that democracy's kind of fake even when it works, because it's really just a function of sort of who's got the megaphone and how much latitude they have to lie.
Yeah, you really see the level of panic set in when the left realized that they may not have the entire thing locked down, or, you know, it might not be just their kind of conservative half allies that are going to keep the system afloat forever that are going to have access to that. Once there were people who were actually looking to change things, it got real weird real fast. There's just a article, I'm probably going to review it next week, that came out from Politico, but talking about how J.D. Vance wants to make the right even more radical. J.D. Vance is the next vanguard of the radical right. He's far more dangerous than Trump. And in some ways, they're right, because...
Terrifying.
But, well, I mean, you know, maybe not on a personal level, but Vance and many of the people connected now on the right are really looking at systems. Oh, okay, it's not just about winning an election and saying, I have a better policy position than this guy. They understand that they need to control bureaucracies, that they need to control media outlets, that they need to spin narratives. They understand that the entire machine is up for grabs and needs to be controlled, not simply the formal articles listed in the Constitution. And while they're still not very terrifying people in the vision that they're looking for, you know, the United States from a left-wing perspective, simply the fact that they understand that there's a real game, like that they actually can see some of the real levers of power behind the screen rather than simply grasping at the artificial kind of civics lesson power. That is enough to scare the left, to terrify the left, because if they actually start moving a few of those things and they realize that you can actually make significant changes this way, that's a very different game. The left has relied on the fact that no conservative administration actually has a hope of touching power. Like they're at the best, you know, going to slow things down and probably in many ways just continue the speed or accelerate it in certain areas. They're not used to the idea that people would actually hold anything of the machine accountable and be able to change things once they move into the office.
Yeah. That essentially exactly what is happening is voting is becoming real and they are trying to make it illegal. It's a prophecy being fulfilled before your eyes. And Project 2025 is really interesting from that perspective, because at least ostensibly it's like, it's conservatives getting together and being like, hey, you know, what if we stopped pretending that the system works the way that you like learned it did in seventh grade? And what if we actually tried to manipulate some procedural outcomes? And you know, of course, this is like bog standard. I mean, that's just the way that the Democrats do business. But the thought that someone adversarial to them might attempt any of that, it's they're revealing the extent to which their here's what it is. The right wing is becoming cynical. And the left wing is like feigning shock over how cynical they've become, but in the process, they can't pretend that they haven't been doing this for decades. And so it's you know, one side is sort of talking about how shocked they are about what's happening to democracy, but neither side believes in democracy, except in the sense in which, now I know people have said, like, you know, when they say democracy, what they mean is sort of the consensus-making institutions. But I think there's a deeper sense in which what they think of when they think of democracy, at least the sort of vanguard, the really ideological wing of the DNC, they are thinking of this sort of individualistic, egalitarian, democracy in the sense of like what a Soviet was supposed to be, where everything is subject to the democratic process. Everything is subject to committee and collective decision making. And I mean, you know, I'm sort of talking around the longhouse here, but that's what they think of when they think of democracy.
So let me ask you this before we move on, because I'm always interested in people's take on this. I hear what you're saying. They don't, many of them don't believe in it, especially on the left, but it feels like on the right, a lot of people did. Like, so you're familiar, I'm sure, with my buddy Bog Beef of the Good Old Boys, right? And sure. He is a man who goes on the internet with a, you know, Randy Savage, 8-bit moniker. His name is Bog Beef. He speaks in an incredibly thick Southern accent. And he explains to people that the square peg goes in the square hole for a living. That's his entire, like, in a very comedic fashion, an entertaining fashion, his entire brand is to explain that, like, politics is about doing stuff for people. And if you promise people stuff and then you bring them stuff, they'll vote for you. And that idea,
yeah,
is just the most radical thing. Like, he could hold a seminar. You could sit him down with the entire conservative commentariat and half of DC and just say, like, here is the square peg. Here is the square, like, all right, you can leave your $5,000 on the table. Make sure you pay on the way out. Like, he could charge for this, right? Because it seems insane, yep. But when I have been in some of these rooms, and you really are explaining this to people, like, that really is something they have just never heard. They're like guys who work at think tanks are like turning the block around and being like, square peg, you said. Like, it really is. It's an amazing thing to watch. How did the right get here? Like, what, how, like, there's the repeating of a myth. I get it. Like, I taught American civics. I understand. But these are professional shape placers, you know, like, this is what they do for a living. Mm-hmm. How is it that these people really did? And I'm promising you, like, a lot of them really like, the idea of patronage just blows their mind. They can't wrap their head around it. How did we get here for the right? I understand left is useful to them, but how does the right get here?
Well, I think you are confronting again the sort of evaporation of some fictions. Because I think in prior eras, like, America's been around a long time, and we've had at least the shape of this government for a minute, and these problems are coming to a head right now, because of a lot of the phenomena that I've already discussed about social media. We are much closer to direct democracy than we were at any other period in American history. And when you, if you were a conservative politician in the 1950s or the 1830s or whatever, you could sort of guide the state paternalistically in directions that hurt some of your voters, but that were good for the system as a whole, you know, because democracy was fake. And there was tons of friction in the system that you could exploit to maintain your power. And that's actually not like a totally bad thing. Like, you know, the criticism of the Electoral College or even just the existence of the Senate on the left is always like, well, it's this impediment to democracy. And conservatives have to make this case. And they can't quite, or most of them don't say it quite like this, but like, yeah, that's the point. We want an impediment to democracy. We want the popular will to not be manifest, you know, directly. And I think Republicans are like right in principle and in theory about like how you ought to govern a state, right? Like you shouldn't spend more than you take in, and like you should care about the reproduction of families, and you should care about rewarding good behavior and penalizing bad behavior, and in a system where the democracy was like really pretty fake, you could get away with a lot of those policy positions and like doing what was right for the country. But now there's no firewalls, there's nothing in the way of it just being pure Gibbs. And so this, like, the State of the Union, going back to kind of to tie a bow on it, like, it is effortless for a Democratic president to deliver a State of the Union, no matter what's going on, because he can always just say, like, honestly, there were things he mentioned where he was like, I'm gonna deploy this free shit to you, free stuff. And I was thinking like, oh, that'd be good. I'd like to have that free stuff, you know? And it's, you know, as long as he can, make, 60% of the people like wealthier in an immediate sense at the expense of like, you know, 25% of the people or whatever it is, in a way that of course long run damages the whole system and impoverishes everybody. But like in this instant, immediate sense, he'll win. And he doesn't have to talk about the national debt. He doesn't have to talk about Social Security. He doesn't have to talk about like the trajectory at all, because that's not what he's rewarded for doing. And so basically, it's just the division between Democratic and Republican politics is absolutely this: the Democratic Party, they don't have a coherent ideology. It's just the institution in power that has been shaped by the incentives that operate upon it. And the Republican Party is this sort of reserve of ideas that are actually in principle good ideas, but that don't sell. And so like that, it creates this useful fiction of tension in the system, when really the DNC is the apex predator. It is purpose built and designed to thrive in under our political conditions. And so, I mean, the Republican Party are essentially Indian agents. Like their job is to maintain the fiction of regular, predictable legal relations between the American kulak and the U.S. government. Because what the Indian agent would do is he would go there and he would say, yeah, we're going to take a little bit more of your stuff, but you better be glad I'm around, because if I wasn't around, it'd be way worse. It'd be way worse. And you're lucky we have these regular relations, and you'd better obey the law, because if not, the expropriation will happen faster. And I can't think of a sense in which that does not describe the modern Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, as Nick Land pointed out in The Dark Enlightenment, this is a democracy problem, right? The things that sell in democracy are what the Democrats do, and the things that don't work in democracy are what the Republicans do. And the only reason that the Republicans exist is because you do need to have the dialectic before you can expropriate everything. Unless you want to.
And we're getting better at democracy.
Right. Absolutely.
That's where we are.
So obviously we've talked about the impending financial collapse, the reason that the Democrats need to go ahead and serve their clients and not the citizens, the methods by which they're going to seek to expropriate. Now, in your article, you do talk about some solutions. You do talk about some ways that people can guard against this. That's actually the purpose. You have an organization called Exit. You guys get people in positions where they're harder to cancel, harder to liquidate, harder to take advantage of. Could you give us a few strategies here, a few solutions for the possible attempts at expropriation that we're probably going to face from somebody in the Biden administration?
Yeah. So, okay. I think it's worth addressing the fact that this egregore that we're up against, this sort of blob, has strengths and it has weaknesses. And one of its weaknesses is, like, we talk about how the DNC is not concerned about the deficit. They're not concerned about Social Security. They're very like short run win elections, right? And that is actually a weakness that we can exploit, because if you are not, it doesn't have the ability to strategize. It doesn't have the ability to sniff you out if you are not sort of directly in the line of its like coercive machinery. So do you have free speech in America? In some sense, you have more freedom of speech than you've ever had in a practical sense, right? Like we were saying, our reach, as ordinary schlubs. And because that's become dangerous, there's a lot more limits on your speech in terms of but here are the methods. It's HR. They can get you fired from your job. They can convince your wife that she's not going to have any friends if you keep running your mouth on the internet. Or they can come after your kids. And if those three things are rock solid, like if you make your own money, then you in a meaningful sense have more free speech than you've ever had in the history of this country. If you're making your own money and you're mobile, then you have leverage over whatever jurisdiction you're in, right? Like the fact that Elon didn't expect the state of Delaware to like burn down. So the state of Delaware's whole export is just corporate law. Like that's all that happens in Delaware, is you just incorporate your business in Delaware, and they offer this promise of like minimal taxes, minimal regulation. It's very smooth, and that's why everybody incorporates there. And Elon, I think not totally unreasonably, thought like, well, surely they won't just light their political capital on fire to come after me. But of course they did, to the tune of like, what, $56 billion, some outrageous amount of money. And then he moved to Texas. And so there's jurisdictional arbitrage. That's, I'm currently actually in the great state of Texas because I'm relocating there for this reason, to get to a friendlier jurisdiction and friendlier people. I think that's a huge piece of it. There's also just like social capital. Like I was having a conversation with a friend about, like, you know, if you were like 60 and you needed your wealth to last through whatever this calamity is, right? You're not a young guy making high risk moves. Like, you have to just make it through. Would you rather have like rich and smart kids and good like social connections, or would you rather have like a 401k and a bunch of dollars? And I think it's people. I think people are what's going to survive this thing, especially as the system expels competence.
Right.
Like, it's people who can't, it's people who won't lie and who want to accomplish things. Like, Elon is not an ideologue. Elon is basically like a 90s tech libertarian guy. He doesn't care about like who's gay or like race. He's just like, they won't let me go to Mars. They won't let me build. They won't let me do anything. And that's who the system is radicalizing and expelling. And so exit for me is like, I want to scoop up as many of those people as I can, get them in a room, get them building things on the outside, so that when the system collapses, number one, the things I care about are out of the blast radius, right? But also so that kind of in the aftermath, we're not like looking around like how do we get started? What do we do? What do we build? I want people who have that experience of building and who are already like kitted out to build for what's next.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you that the competency, the human capital is going to be increasingly valuable. And a lot of these signifiers like dollars and things that are just highly open to manipulation have been completely diluted in quality. That's going to be the stuff that's not useful. And so putting your time and investment and making sure that that's what you're surrounding yourself with, I think is far better than having these loose material things that are the regime can completely lock you out of or devalue at a moment's notice. I think that's great advice. All right, guys, well, we're going to move over to the questions of the people. But before we do, Kevin, can you go ahead and tell people where to find your work, Exit, all of this stuff?
Yeah, so exitgroup.us is the site for what we do. We have accountability groups, working groups. We get together in meetups. It's all about helping guys launch businesses and get their families more squared away and more independent. I'm also on Twitter at extradeadjcb. And the Substack is blog.exitgroup.us. So you can sign up there.
Excellent. All right, guys, make sure that you're checking out all of his work. All right. Creeper Weirdo says, why do commies hate farmers so much? It's ideological or something that I'm missing. It's just, it's not just here. It's literally in every country. Yeah. Very interestingly, one of my Blaze colleagues today was like, I was just looking this up and I realized that the average kulak had like 8 acres, and I don't think I could afford 8 acres right now. Like, so we're not even in the position of the kulaks at this point. But yeah, why do they always hate the kulaks?
Well, I think farming, and it's not the only thing that's like this. Farming is kind of between you and God. Like, and I don't mean, well, it's not just that, but you are very close to the fruit of what you produce. Like you, there's not a lot of intermediaries. There's not a lot of, other things going on. It's really just you work, you produce, and that creates a sense of like ownership and sovereignty, and it's yours. And what they really oppose is that. They oppose ownership and sovereignty because they regard it as inegalitarian, which it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Oswald Spengler talks about people going back to the land at the end of a civilization. Like once you get to the winter and before something new is born, people kind of go back to the land because it's the only thing that seems true and real and reconnects you to perhaps the spiritual in a way that you've been away from for so long. And it's interesting that there is this truth that the more civilized we become, the more abstract our existence becomes and more dependent it is on artificial systems, the more people seem to despise those that are still in connection with those things. And so it's almost like they look at that and they need to spit on it. They need, because there's that ugly reflection of like, there's a story today about, some British paper warning that like pictures of the British landscape could stir dangerous, dark, nationalistic feelings. And it really does feel this like, what? Oh, if people could see outside the casino, like if the windows aren't blacked out all the time, they might realize that they don't want to just sit in front of the machine and pull the lever until they die. And so we got to black out all the windows, you know, and that I think that really is as part of the hatred. It's like those guys go outside. And,
I would almost. Yeah. I actually to scramble the categories a little bit, though, I actually think that is part of why a lot of the tech bros are on our side these days and why they hate the tech bros, because it's like just me and my laptop, baby. And we, I made this, you know, and you can't credibly, like if you're a factory worker, you're totally integrated to a managerial system. Your product is not really your product. But if you can make $1 billion with literally just a laptop, you have this psychological sense of like, I don't know, maybe deserve, I don't know if that's the right word, but like it is yours. And yeah, it's the sort of intellectual equivalent to that. And yeah, you're able to leave the country. You're able to store assets outside their jurisdiction. You're just not under their control, and that's what they hate.
Yeah. No longhouse for you. That's the real problem. Arthur T says, should we prepare for a Weimar American Republic in the next 10 to 15 years, hyperinflation and all the horrors that entail it? I think that timeline is way too optimistic. we get these stories about how it's already you need 80% or more money from just 4 years ago to buy a home. Guys, if you already have all the horrors when it comes to, you know, sexualization and children and everything, I don't think you're as far away from that timeline as you might think.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine it taking 15 years. Like I say, within 11 years, it's the complete consumption of the entire American economy, essentially.
Right.
There's no question. But I actually, the picture that I have in my mind, first of all, the Germans on both sides, the left and the right, were veterans of a pretty savage war, and they had a lot more. I think we should account for the fact that America is very fat and very hormonally sick. And the best analogy that what I think it's going to look more like is the post-Soviet collapse, because there's not a dramatic, there's not like these very striking, very strong-willed competitor ideologies that are like, I know the answer, I know what to do. Nobody knows what to do. And I think it's going to be much more just like gangsterism and corruption and theft of sort of the commons. That's what I envision.
Yeah, when Soviet managerialism collapsed, you had other competing forms of managerialism that's were still on the rise, that still had a lot of life left in them. This feels like the complete end of a system, not just a flavor of systems. Yeah, and that's of course, that's it's an entire own episode. But I think so much of people's confusion about where we're at is, it's Soviets versus liberal democracy versus fascism. It's like, no, guys, this is all just flavors of the same system. And the reason you can't imagine anything out of it is it's literally the only thing that's existed for over 100 years. Creeper Weirdo says, question everything and you'll only be right 20 to 50% of the time when you're right. Yeah, exactly. This is the, I've said this before, this is the Alex Jones gambit, right? Like, is Alex Jones right about everything? No, absolutely not. In fact, he says many insane things. But he assumes that the people he's arguing against are completely evil, and he's right about that. And so, like, he just questions literally everything. And so, yeah, like, he says some crazy things, but he also just happens to be right a lot of the time because the people he's criticizing are really, truly evil, and he really is just going to have a pretty decent batting average by just assuming that they are, like, truly horrific and demonic.
Yeah, I think he also he discredits some of that questioning by how, like, crazy his conclusions are. I think the safest thing you can say about, like, Epstein is, and they build this out on purpose because they know the facts. And so if you come up with a really, like, crystalline theory of like what actually happened, they know how to pick it apart because they know what the facts are. The way that you avoid that, like, pre-caricature and that attack is you just say, I don't know what happened, but I know they're lying. I know they're lying. They're obviously lying. And that's AJ's power is he just points out to you that they're full of crap, and they totally are.
Yeah, I love that this system, practice of just calling out the system constantly has shifted people like him, people like Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, who now sounds like the most reactionary prophet you've ever seen, because he's just doing the same thing. He's just like, no, the system is horrible, and these are the people in charge, and so I will just attack them, and now I sound like Thomas Carlyle. But all right. King Pilled, recent guest on the show. Great having you on, man. Thanks for coming by. He says, time to develop networks that generate right-coded GIBs in return for explicit fealty in the short term, and clear the terrain for us to flex our civilization building muscles in the long term. Yeah, that's a lot, of course, of what Kevin's talking about. We didn't get deep into this, but just to briefly touch on this topic, one of the reasons that the right hasn't been able to do this is twofold. One, they're not allowed to explicitly fight for anyone. The left is allowed to explicitly fight for people and promise them stuff directly. And the right's entire or at least the conservative right's entire modus operandi has been the exact opposite. We're never allowed to fight for specific people, and we're never allowed to promise them anything. The other reason is, and many people have pointed this out to kind of counter what Bogbeef has said, that it's a fair point, the left can promise because they are the expropriators, because their coalition is made up of people who can't produce, and so they can punish the people who do produce because they're on the other side of the fence. How does the right promise people and deliver when all the productive people are inside the tent and you can't take anything from those that aren't producing anything?
Yeah. Well, there was a whole discourse on this the last couple of days about why and whether right-wing billionaires should support the arts. And partly I think you're right. Like, it's difficult to conceive of, like, is there a way to say right-coded GIBs that isn't just the same thing as National Socialism? Like, the right-coded is national, the GIBs is socialism. And so, like, that's something that's been essentially illegal across the entire West since 1945. You would have to radically rethink what that looks like for that to be sellable. But also, yeah, I think you've pointed out a really important point, which is that, here's what I think it is. I think you have to restore healthy hierarchies. I think if the person being taken from is a dupe and is being punished, then yeah, no competent person would go for that. But if you can say, like, you are this person's patron, you are their superior, and you can find a way to restore people to positions of superiority and inferiority without contempt and without resentment, where they feel themselves part of something. One of the things that was so emotionally satisfying about the first Dune movie was the fact that you had genuine love and loyalty and belonging between superiors and inferiors. That was an incredibly like exotic emotional experience for most people. And it was one of the things that made that movie emotionally resonant. And I think that's kind of how you get back to that place if you can.
Yeah, you create that relationship of duty and dependence again. You make it okay for people to acknowledge that. You don't need to elevate the dependent, and you don't need to punish those who are naturally above in the hierarchy. You can honor those below you through duty, and you can, you know, go ahead and offer loyalty to those who you are dependent upon. And that's something that is the most natural relationship, and probably the most right-wing of all formations, if we're going to apply crude political structures to an ancient form of being.
It's love. It's love. Yeah. And it's an abstraction of all government is an abstraction of the family.
Right.
Patria, patriotism, patronage. It's all abstractions of the relationships of authority within a family. And the more abstract they become, the more challenging it is to hold them together, but also the bigger they can scale. And that's sort of where managerialism has come from. I don't want to go off the rails. I know we're short on time, but like the farther you get from that, the harder it is to maintain the emotional resonance, but the easier it is to like scale in size. And what we've come up against is like the abstraction no longer holds together. Like, what the hell is an American at this point? We have there's just nothing binding us together anymore. And so we have to get back to a place where there are bonds of love and loyalty that will get people to behave as if their interests were aligned when they in fact are not. And on the right currently, like the sort of tech right, libertarian right, the econ right, it's like the only way that our interests can be aligned is if there's a rate of return. And we have to get away from that. We have to find other ways to align our interests.
Absolutely. Alexander Jean says, thoughts on Edmund Burke and Alexis de Tocqueville. Well, of course, Burke is the classic conservative. Many people look at him as the first conservative. He is a liberal, but makes a strong case for kind of that that classic English type of conservatism. I prefer other writers, but Burke makes some good points. De Tocqueville is interesting. I think pretty much everyone just reads Democracy in America if they read him at all. And I know he wrote a lot more than that. And to be honest, I have only read Democracy in America, and it was a long time ago. So I don't know if I can give you a wider opinion on de Tocqueville there, other than he has some good insights in Democracy in America.
Yeah, my only take on de Tocqueville is that the fact that all of the social institutions that held America together that he thought were so powerful, the collapse of that in the wake of industrialization and the rise of feminism, basically that's women held all that together. And it was a really powerful thing about America. And the only way you rebuild that is if you get women doing that again.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yes, another question. How can we be sure that transcommunism won't take over after the collapse? Well, because that's highly artificial. That's something you have to understand, man. It's like that whole system can only exist because of the level of complex abstractions holding it together. And so if things collapse, like, where do you get that surgery? Like, where do you get those drugs? Like, how do you make people clients of big pharma once the technology and economic system required for it to exist completely collapses? The collapse isn't something you should wish for, but the reason that a lot of people see it as the way towards anything right wing is that all of left wing is all left wing things are artificial. The right wing things are those which are based on natural axioms, the things that have to exist in nature. All of these left wing things are things that are built on these highly complex abstractions that we have created. And once those are gone, there's just no way for them to continue in the same form.
I'm sure you've seen that that tweet where the guy was like, all trans socialists need to be armed for the revolution. And like, it's just like a mile of replies that are like, no, actually I'm deeply mentally ill and I would kill myself if I had access to a firearm.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, they're in no condition.
Yeah. Zombie apocalypse, for better or for worse, burns away the chaff quite quickly. There's no other way for that to go down. All right, guys, we're gonna go ahead and wrap.
And hopefully the chaff within a man, you know.
It's true.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, absolutely. All right, we're gonna wrap it up. But Kevin, thanks. It's always so great talking to you guys. Make sure that you check out his work. Make sure that you check out Exit. It's a great organization. And of course, if it's your first time on this channel, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe. Turn on the notifications, click the bell, because YouTube's like, what? You actually want to see people you're subscribed to? We don't do that, especially for right wingers. So make sure that you go ahead and do that. Of course, if you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, you need to go ahead and subscribe to the Orr McIntyre Show in your favorite podcast platform. When you do, leave a rating or a review. It really helps with the algorithm magic. I hope everybody has a great weekend. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.